Welcome to The Lob, your home of in-depth coverage and analysis by These Football Times, a movement of journalism you can trust. Each week, we endeavour to bring you the very best coverage of the game, exploring stories from the past and present with analysis by expert guests from around the world. Find more of our award-winning content online and in print. In the meantime, enjoy the podcast.
Hello and welcome to another edition of the South Africa Files, the City's version. Now, after a false start that was very rudely interrupted by Christmas, the band are still together. We still didn't fall out. There was no family arguments over Christmas. It's either episode 2 or episode 9, Gary. Am I right?
If you say so, buddy. I mean, yeah, I mean,
Do the rate or nine. Anyway, we're all here and ready to go. Christmas has been and gone, so now we can complete our sojourn around the South American cities discussing the beautiful game. I will introduce the co-hosts, the students, the pupils, and then I'll introduce the teacher at the end. Clearly, it's no surprise if you've listened to all the other episodes. But first of all, the man who came up with the project with what seems like another lifetime ago. We're getting through it. Mr. Gary Thacker. Gary, welcome.
Thanks, dear. Yeah, it took a while, but it's 1,265 miles from Medellin to where we are to where we're going to talk about tonight. And we've landed at the airport Jorge Chavez, a city founded in 1535 by the conquistador Francisco Pizarro, and originally was called Ciudad de los Reyes, the City of the Kings. When we start talking about the football clubs there who have won 70 titles between them, you'll probably understand why. It's the capital of Peru. We're into Lima tonight, mate.
We are indeed. And like I say, as we discussed earlier, I've packed my marmalade sandwiches.
Good man.
Ready to go. Thank you.
I've got my duffel coat on as well. My red hat.
Excellent. Well done, you. Can't wait to hear Stephen's little bit of foreign language to see how he joins the conversation. Mr. Stephen's Greg. Stephen, welcome. You can now follow Gary's little introduction if you want. You don't have to, but...
Ready and prepared to butcher the Spanish language at any at all junctures. That's a given now. I think nine episodes in, episode 2 of the second leg or whatever we are. Then yeah, everyone's fair game, and yeah, if there'll be some kind of critical takedown of Everton within the first 17 minutes, I'm pretty sure.
That's Everton switched off. But what are we in 2.5 minutes? Excellent.
But then again, I think Southampton got even managed to get within the double barrels last time. So you know, anyone's that's it. I mean, we've said it before, but this particular series seems to bring out the freedom the studs are up.
I can't decide if you're an expert sniper marksman who boldly and calculatingly take teams out, or whether it's more a scattergun. You can all have it. Approach. I'm not sure where you lie at the moment.
All challenges above the knee.
Love that. And yeah. Finally, the man who will actually bring some intelligence and order to the podcast, and without who, maybe it'd just be Steve and Gary and I chatting about random stuff. Dr. Pete, welcome. Thank God you're here and joining us in Lima. Welcome.
Evening, guys. Yeah, I reckon Steve is more the kind of agent provocateur, that kind of snipey little midfielder who goes around just like raking his studs down people and poking people in the back and pulling a drawing pin out of his sock and stabbing someone, and then just running off while, you know, someone else gets punched and a melee begins, and, you know, the armed police get on the pitch, a small dog runs on and has a bit of fun, you know, the crowd start rioting. I mean, Steve is kind of like the instigator of this kind of trouble, that, you know, when we in the kind of South American context, that's very much his role, I think.
it's no coincidence that my hair has got longer and longer since this particular series kicked in. It is now shoulder length as well.
I feel like you're a South American Dennis Wise. I think he's out.
South American Vinnie Jones. What was that game? Yeah. He was but within about 8 seconds, yeah, or so that time.
Yeah, that's it. There we go. Wimbledon, I'd love you. So, in all seriousness, we are in Lima. We are in Peru. And as always, we have, believe it or not, we do have a plan and a slight format that follows this series and follows these podcasts. And usually the first bit, which is the bit I really like, is where Dr. Pete just pretty much astounds us with his knowledge of football in Lima. So, really, Dr. Pete, over to you. and the football clubs in Lima.
If we start rather rarely with the big ones, and then we'll go on to the much more fun small ones that sadly aren't in existence anymore, but deserve mention. I guess that one of the slightly interesting things maybe about Lima is that if you look at the top two divisions, there's probably less clubs from Lima there than quite a lot of the other cities, particularly if you look at the likes of Argentina, Uruguay. So we don't quite have the same condensation of clubs in the capital that other South American countries do have. That wasn't always the case. One of the things that we probably talked about in the Peru episode in Series 1 of the South American Files was that at the start of Peruvian organized football, it was very much a kind of Lima and Callao only division. So you have a lot of kind of small sides, of club sides from those two cities that form the backbone of, you know, the origins of Peruvian football. And we'll come to some of those teams in a minute. But, you know, we have the kind of founding clubs of Lima Cricket. We actually have played cricket for Chile against Peru. There's part of my international cricketing career for you. And then we also have Union Cricket as well. But then eventually the rest of the country is allowed to join in the fun. And what you get is obviously more clubs from the different provinces of Peru joining, but then some of the kind of the classic older teams from Lima, you know, slipping down the leagues and disappearing, which is a bit of a shame. But anyway, the main clubs in Lima, we've got Alianza Lima, probably one of the clubs that has been written about most in academia, actually. It's one of those key topics by academics. One of my actual PhD supervisor, David Wood, wrote about them. A great guy called Aldo Panfich has written a book about Alianza Lima as well as various others. So they're one of the kind of the great historic clubs of the country. And their eternal rivals are Universitario. They're the kind of the massive derby. The other two, I suppose, major established clubs in the capital are Sporting Cristal. They are one of the slightly newer boys. They weren't one of the original teams that started that league, but were formed on the back of Sporting Tabaco, a club that was based around a tobacco company. And actually, it was founded by people who owned a brewery, the Backers and Johnson company. So you had a pretty much a perfect combination of cigarettes and alcohol when Sporting Cristal came into operation. And actually, they came as champion. They won their first championship in the league. In the first year they joined the league. So they're known as the club that was born the champion. The other kind of major club, I suppose, is Deportivo Municipal, who've kind of always been, you know, around about, you know, there in the league. They won four titles about 80 years ago and they've never really troubled anyone ever since, but are still there and doing fairly well. And then you have probably, I guess, the club that was created, one of those slightly franchisey type project clubs, Club Deportivo Universidad de San Martín de Porres, who were, you know, kind of recent entry into the kind of league system and had a nice little phase of success in the late 2000s. In the kind of early 2000s. So they're the clubs that kind of everyone are still in the league. They're still there and present. But I think it's worth giving attention to some of the great names of clubs that were back in the day. The two that I want to highlight are clubs that were created by aviators. I think he really, you know, in our kind of Hanna-Barbera kind of themed wacky races type thing, these two clubs probably would be associated with the Stop the Pigeon franchise and series. We've got Jorge Chavez and we've got Sport Juan Bielovucic, named after two aviation pioneers of Peru in the early 1910s who crossed the Andes and crossed the Alps. Bielovucic actually earned the Legion d'Honneur in World War I and also was involved in the French resistance in World War II. And actually, the club did win the league in 1917. So there is a little bit of glory that the club earned alongside the great name. I'm a big fan of Sport Inca. I love kind of these clubs. That's something that interests me, and the clubs that name themselves after indigenous traditions of the country. They're quite rare. Colo Colo is the main one. It's a shame that Sport Inca didn't really survive. And you've got various other clubs like Ciclista Lima, a club that was formed around cycling originally. You've got Regatas Lima, that was a club based around rowing. And finally, and there are various others, but I'm going to concentrate on the marvellously named Atletico Frigorifico, a club that played in the first division in 1931, were relegated and then disappeared pretty much ever since. And their name translated is Atletico Fridge. So I think, you know, we can imagine their players playing it cool. I'll stop there. That's the worst pun I could finish there. But basically, we've got this kind of tradition of small clubs in Lima, often founded by students and schoolboys. A lot of them didn't make the grade. Hopefully a few of them are still existing in certain memories or playing in kind of, you know, these kind of minor pitches and parks around Lima somewhere, you know, still, let's hope so.
Like I say, I love that bit. It really is my favorite part of the entire podcast of the series. One, obviously because of the knowledge, Pete, but also the names of the teams. I literally wait with bated breath to see what we're going to end up with. Cigarettes and alcohol and fridges, I absolutely love it. Gary, for you, Lima certainly seems to be what Pete's just said there, but very much a football city with a heritage, a tradition of football.
Yeah, I mean, it's great, you know, no matter how much research you're doing. I've done some this morning, a couple of hours this morning. Peter always comes up with some things that you missed, you don't know, that, you know, this is what it's great to have such a great, knowledgeable guy on. But I mean, it's interesting you mentioned about clubs formed by the Aviators. I'm surprised you said they were flying high, and, you know, perhaps they, for a short time at least. Yeah, but, you know, as I said earlier, you know, this clubs in Lima have won between them 70 titles. So it's a hotbed of football. Most of those titles were split between the two teams that Pete mentioned. That's Universitario and Alianza, who have sort of flew the flag for Peruvian football. So across the continent as well, you know, in the Libertadores, and although they haven't sort of won it, but they've been successful and competed in the Libertadores, you know, a number of times. So it's great to hear that, you know, a country like Peru, who perhaps is. Maybe you can see we talked about the hierarchy in South American football before, where it's Brazil, Argentina, and then there's Uruguay, and then there's Colombia and Peru. It's great to see that you know, some of the clubs from this sort of second, third round country, you know, do get out there and compete with the big boys of Brazil and Argentina.
I absolutely agree, and I think for you and I, Stephen, certainly Peru from our childhood were very. And I know you're a lover of a sash. I know you're a sash kit. And certainly sort of 78, 82, you know, when Peru hit our radar and there's that mystique that came with the World Cup. But it seems that also exists or existed in the domestic football as well. You know, listening to Pete there, it's almost like it just was just translated from club football straight into international football and then projected onto a world stage via that red sash.
It's totally iconic. You know, that shirt is like nothing else. You know, it runs through club football as well. There's a lot of clubs that wear, you know, varying colours of it that just make me want to go out and buy a lot of football shirts, basically, which just, you know, I might go and do. But I'd just throw one into Sporting Cristal, and it was Sporting Cristal, wasn't it? The club built on cigarettes and alcohol. I'm not sure I approve of the Oasis connotations there. You know. As far as clubs that kind of like went defunct, rose, you know, of all the clubs to live forever, you know, I'm not on for Sporting Cristal. I can automatically say they're not getting my season ticket at the end of the game.
You've just got to roll with it, Stephen. That's all I'm going to say.
some might say I'm being a bit irrational about this, but you know. Whatever, you know.
Oh, brilliant.
Oh, dear.
We're off and running.
Move on.
So, again, Pete, one of the reasons, and certainly I know one of Gary's passions and one of the reasons why the series is great and why we love it, and that then is sort of the political influence that sort of exists around South American football. And it's certainly, you know, we touched on it, like we say, the South American files when we went around the nations. But again, in terms of sort of domestic football and sort of their susceptibility perhaps to political affiliations, or whether or not those political affiliations are what made the club, you know, sort of formed the club and formed the identity of the club. With, you know, with so many clubs in the present that maybe now don't exist, and with the current clubs as well, the political landscape that exists within Peruvian football in Lima and how influential that is.
I think the rivalry, particularly with Universitario and Alianza Lima, is something that's been researched a lot. Again, going back to, you know, David Wood, Aldo Panfici, Jorge Teirot, various other guys who've done a lot of work on this. What's really interesting about this rivalry is that quite often a lot of the other rivalries and social influences that you have in South America, I guess, are often based on class or potentially barrios or potentially who formed them. what's really interesting about these two is that you don't have the just the class aspect, and there definitely is a class, or there was certainly a class division, but you also have a very keen racial division. So Alianza are the team that founded first. Now, actually, they didn't accrue the identity that they've become famous for immediately. They did have slight political linkages in that the kind of the founding story is that they played football in the stud farm, the horse kind of stud of the, I think he was not then president, but became president, a guy called Leguia. It was one of the presidents at the first decades of Peru. So Alianza Lima are founded there, and they're actually founded by, I think, Italians and some kind of working middle. But then the club actually moves, and they moved to a district of Lima called La Victoria, which was very strongly associated with the Afro-Peruvian community, which you can imagine South America at the time, we're talking early 1910s, are not particularly integrated, do not have a particularly strong representation. There's a lot of racial discrimination. But Alianza Lima moved to this district. It's obviously a very working class area, and you know, a lot of black footballers start playing for this particular club, and they become very associated with this kind of the Afro-Peruvian working class identity. A lot of their nicknames are based on that. They were called Los Intimos, the intimate ones. They're all friends. They all knew each other. It was a kind of very strong social network of these black players who were working in different other parts of the city. But some would say, we know you can play. Why don't you come and join us as well? And that was very much part of their foundation narrative, even though in actual fact, as various scholars have proved, they weren't actually... that wasn't their very first identity. It became an assumed identity when they moved. It became a very strong one. I think what's also interesting about the Alianza identity is also that there's quite a strong religious connotation in the fact that they actually changed their colours. It's one of the rare teams that changed their colours at a particular time of the year when it's I think it's in October, and they changed to purple and white in tribute to the Lord of the Miracles. And again, so this kind of close relationship of religion, class and race is something that Alianza have really built on. It might not be quite the same as it used to be. Obviously, these identities change and people support the clubs that they really enjoy and are doing well. But certainly, that's the way the club defines itself, sells itself, and that's how it narrates itself. And there's lots of great players that have kind of a part of that myth, and we'll probably come on to some of those players as we go along. But they're also associated with a style that comes with this Afro-Peruvian-ness, with the kind of typical polka type Peruvian music as well. They became associated with the music that was going on in those clubs around this kind of particular barrio of Lima, and also the players. So there's quite a kind of linkage with stylish, individualistic, good football. The contrast to this is Universitario. They were found around one of the universities. They are basically the club, or were the club, of the educated elite. The Universidad was obviously one of the best ones in the country. It's where a lot of the elite sent their sons. And so they formed this team that were representing this particular sector of society. So you have a kind of class conflict immediately when the two teams first start playing each other in the late 1920s. And also what's interesting about Universitario is that there's a kind of different identity. You know, they're kind of the white club, the upper class club, but also they were seen as being the modern club, the club that was supposedly representing the way that, you know, proper football should be played, organized, disciplined. It was associated with fitness, with organization, with everyone working together as a kind of team. And this is very much counterpointed against what Alianza were representing, a slightly more freer, less controlled style of play, slightly more rough and ready as well. Whereas, you know, Universidad were the kind of opposite. So you have all these kind of polar opposites of where the identities were in terms of class, in terms of race, and also style of football. They're really the clubs that have got the strongest identity. You still have, I mean, Lima Cricket actually, for example, still exists as a football team. There's something like in the Copa Peru, which is effectively the third division. I'm sure they've still got the kind of aristocratic British kind of overtones of club football, of the social club type idea. The other clubs don't have quite the same identity, apart from, I suppose, the nicknames that characterise them, the Cerveceros, the Brewers, effectively, for Sporting Cristal. Deportivo Municipal were more associated with some of the municipal workers and kind of civil servant type, or people who worked for the municipality. That was their kind of identity. So it's not one of those things that immediately grabs your excitement and attention. But they're the clubs that have got the main identities and what they really stand for.
Gary, you must just love this. You must absolutely lap this up. And for me, there's nothing better than a rivalry that is not only between the big clubs, but also is class. You know, that sort of social class that almost is the bedrock of that rivalry. It just, for me, just doesn't get any better than that.
I mean, ain't it just? I mean, we've come across these so many times. We talk about South American football, you know, in the different countries, you know, Argentina, Brazil, Colombia, you know, the other countries we've covered. But I was fascinated to hear Pete say about the religious aspect of Alianza. I living over here in Spain in a strongly Catholic country, I was as he was talking, I was trying to think of a similar situation in Spanish clubs, and I don't think there is one where one club is particularly, I mean, lots of sort of pay homage to, you know, the saints' days and that sort of thing. But that's a fascinating one, and you know, if only, not only because of the adherence to religious orthodoxy, but also how it creates a sense of belonging for the fans as well. You know, this sort of it's our club and it respects our beliefs and that sort of thing is fascinating. So yeah, that was really good to hear that, and you know political adherence to clubs is one thing, but it's, you know, it's interesting to hear that, you know, religion plays a part as well.
And can I just clarify as well, Pete? Sorry, when you talked about that change to the purple kit, is that every season at a certain time, or is
No, it's kind of, there's, I guess you get these kind of particular religious periods of kind of religious holidays, for example, or saints days, that kind of thing. Again, I should have probably checked exactly what the time frame is. I know it's in October, and it relates to kind of other celebrations that are going on in, you know, they're quite associated with this particular barrio, you know, the Lord of Miracles. So, you know, and again, it is very unusual. I mean, I think that, you know, you don't often get, I mean, there, you know, this, I think there is a lot of religiosity in football, and it does get preyed upon. I think there's a strong example of a lot of the Brazilian players who are kind of, you know, there is a very strong religious element. A lot of them follow, you know, a particular type of religious practice that's very overt, you know, and actually a lot of that was preyed upon by Bolsonaro, and a lot of the reason why some of the most religious players in Brazil are Bolsonaristas, which has led them into various conflict. And you do have a lot of tradition, you do have a lot of praying. I think there was one example, I'm trying to remember the player who was talking about it, was in Colombia, and I have a feeling that he was playing for Union Magdalena, and he said he thought it was bizarre that some of the players were being criticized because they weren't praying enough, that the reason the clubs weren't doing well is because they weren't praying hard enough before and after games, you know. So there is this kind of sense of religion somehow guiding fortunes of footballers. There's a real strong kind of feature of least religiosity. It might not be necessarily as tightly connected with the club as it is with the Alianza Lima at that particular time of the year, but you know, it certainly is a kind of a feature of, you know, football. And I guess that kind of rituality of the whole football as a temple, as our church, as our, you know, we have our songs, we have our dress, we have our practices, we do what we do every, you know, Saturday afternoon, Sunday, whatever time it is. There is a lot of that kind of, I guess, religiosity about the way football is played, spectated, and I guess kind of, you know, as a faith construct or a faith target in lots of ways.
I remember Kaká, whenever he scored goal, I did it all the time, but he pulled his shirt, he had a T-shirt underneath saying "I belong to Jesus," and I'm writing a book about Brazil 1970 at the moment, and Pelé makes a big play about how the players all got together and prayed together, you know, as part of not to pray for success, but sort of as part of that culture, and just a juxtaposition of that. I don't know if you guys have seen this, I've seen this on Twitter. I think it's Napoli, I might be wrong, so forgive me, Napoli fans, if I am wrong. For St. Valentine's Day, they've got a shirt designed specially with like a big lipstick kiss on the side of it to sort of celebrate St. Valentine's Day, which is perhaps less devout than it should be, but recognises, you know, some kind of nod to religion. Interesting though, the football clubs and religion, you know, why shouldn't they do that? You know, I mean, as I say, it creates a sense of belonging for the fans as well.
I've just thought of another example as well. I think it's San Lorenzo. I think if we go back to the Buenos Aires episode, trying to dig back into my memories, I have a feeling that they were associated with a priest who allowed them to play in the kind of the yard of the church.
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah, I think it's San Lorenzo.
I remember.
And that's you know, the name of the club is St. Lawrence. Yeah. And again, I think, again, the detail is that the Pope, isn't he a San Lorenzo fan, isn't he? So there's, you know, I guess that's another kind of a tie-in.
Yeah.
Oh, and another one, actually. Sorry, there's another one. The Colombian, some of the first teams in Bogota were in some of the schools that were based around religious orders, like the Bartolino school was another one. So, but that's a slightly more, I suppose, origins of football as opposed to a club that's got a very focused identity. I mean, Santa Fe, Saint Faith, you know, although again, just a Catholic club, that was the old name of Bogota before independence. So yeah, I mean, there's you know, these religious identities and links are there for, you know, when you go looking for them.
Just remind me of St. Pauli in Germany. You couldn't have a less religious club than St. Pauli.
And I suppose, you know, Stephen, for you, it's, again, you know, football lays itself open, as we've talked about, you know, we've just talked about how it lays itself open to political influence, but obviously it lays itself open to religious influence. You know, we only need to look at sort of in Glasgow, you know, for a very close to home sort of example there. But again, you know, we talk a lot about football and political affiliations, but I'm interested in your opinion on football and religious affiliations and what your opinion perspective maybe is on that.
I mean, a lot of these instances are deep rooted within the foundations of the club, though, you know, and certain landscapes still have, you know, huge religious burden across their communities, you know, less so in others. You know, even closer to home, Everton started life out as St. Domingo. You know, even at Goodison, there's a church on the corner. So, you know, there has been, you know, beyond Celtic Rangers, you know, there've been UK instances of it. But, you know, it goes back to the foundations of clubs. You know, I'm never going to turn around and say, you know, detach religion from football, because it's just the same as saying detach politics from football. You know, you simply can't. If that's the way you lean, that's the way you lean. You know, I'm not particularly religious, you know, so, you know, I wouldn't have been drawn towards a club for religious purposes or religious reasons, but I'd never knock someone who is.
Like I say, it is absolutely fascinating, Pete, the sort of this, well, certainly for me, this sort of steep learning curve about the tradition and like I say, the influences that exist on domestic football in South America, you know, the influences that push and pull are incredible and have been through time. So moving on to the next bit, and obviously, you know, Gary and yourself have mentioned about the sort of the success rate of clubs from Lima within domestic football. But, you know, just a little bit more detail about that domestic success, but probably certainly the bits I'm more interested in, and that's continental success. You know, we discussed this and where for me, it gives a far better context in terms of where domestic football sits within South America rather than just within its own nation.
Yeah, sure. I've just got two more examples of religious clubs that I really want to bring up, because I suddenly remember them. You've got Atlanta in Buenos Aires, which has a very strong Jewish identity. What we've talked a lot about clubs that have the Catholic identity or Catholicism. So that's a club which represented that different community. And I guess on the other scale of things, you have Palestino in Santiago, which we'll probably talk about later on in the series, spoiler alert. But yeah, going back to the question about titles, yeah, there is a kind of a, you know, a very much a dominance of actually three clubs. You know, Universitario and Alianza Lima have got the most trophies. Alianza Lima have won the last couple of seasons. But actually, I think you have to look at Sporting Cristal as being, I guess, the strongest club in the national professional league era. You know, when they allowed the teams from, you know, Cusco, from, you know, the rest of the country to join in. Sporting Cristal have probably got the best record. You know, you look at a lot of titles in the 1990s, the 2000s. A lot of the titles really of Alianza Lima are slightly further back. There's a real kind of a fallow period in the 1980s and 90s where they struggled to assert themselves, and a lot of that was to do with the air crash of 1987, I think it was, which you know decimated that particular team. In terms of the European, as the sorry, the Latin American continental success, this is really where Peruvian clubs have really failed to kind of establish themselves as fully as somewhere like Colombia, for example, which have had a few triumphs. I think there's only been two finals, if I remember rightly. Universitario get there in 1972. They lose to Independiente from Argentina in their particular strong run. That was the great kind of Independiente decade of success. The other team that I think kind of got there was Sporting Cristal, who lost to Cruzeiro in somewhere around 1997. Again, what's good about Cristal, though, was that they had a run of 17 games without defeat in the Libertadores, which is quite some success because they weren't just playing against teams from Bolivia and Venezuela in that kind of particular period. So, you know, that was a particularly decent team around about that time. I think it was back in 1969. And again, there's a lot of good Argentinian teams, a lot of good Uruguayan teams, a lot of good Brazilian teams. You know, Santos is still playing at that time, for example. So, again, I think it's the great Peruvian disappointment that the decade that everyone thought they might have managed it, obviously the 1970s, the year of the great national teams, probably, if anything, the talent was a little bit too dispersed around the three or four major clubs for them to really make a challenge at a continental level. And you also have some phenomenally strong teams in the rest of the continent that deny them at that time. Unfortunately, I guess, you know, the standings of where they are now is really struggling. You know, you don't really see the Peruvian clubs making, you know, the latter stages of the Libertadores. Maybe once in a while a club will do relatively well in the Sudamericana. I think Sport Boys and I know Cienciano were the team that shocked everyone by having a good run there. But, you know, they haven't quite had that breakthrough that someone like, you know, Ecuador's Independiente del Valle had, the Colombian clubs have managed it. You know, it's still something that I know, you know, it's going to be the thing that basically becomes the greatest bragging right for whichever club manages to achieve it, you know, whether it's going to be Alianza, whether it's going to be Universitario, whether it's going to be Sporting Cristal. But in actual fact, it's going to be very hard for any of them to really make that breakthrough, given the way the leagues are, given the way the finances are, and given the pretty much dominance of the Brazilian clubs nowadays anyway.
And to be fair, Gary, that's again what I was going to come to there, that, you know, sort of step up that, You know, Pete's mentioned the two finals there, and that closest almost within touching distance. And, you know, when you happen to come across teams like it's about Independiente, you know, when you unfortunately you have that dominant team that you come up against, you could argue any other year or any other opponent, and that would have been your time. But certainly for seasoned observers of South American football and those who take a keen interest in the domestic game, do you think that, like we did with the Champions League, that repetition, once we get to the last 16 of the Champions League, it becomes, the ties and the fixtures become very repetitive. Do you think that exists as well in the Copa Libertadores, and that the Copa Libertadores needs that success from other nations, you know, to reinvigorate the tournament?
Yeah, it's one of those eternal questions. You know, I think the answer is yes. Is it going to happen? Probably no. Would it be great if Grasshopper Zurich won the Champions League? Would it be refreshing? Well, yes, it would. Is it going to happen? Not on your Nelly. I mean, you know, I think the problem is that, you know, we can sort of think things would be nice if that happened, but sort of also we need to recognise they're probably not going to happen. It's you know, I mean, fascinating. Pete was mentioning about the 70s when, you know, the great Peruvian team, national team, and as I mentioned earlier, I'm sort of working on that sort of subject at the moment, and the Peruvian team that played in the 1970 World Cup were spread across a number of clubs. There wasn't a concentration of the great players all playing in one club. And if they had, perhaps that would have given them a chance to sort of be more competitive in the continental tournaments. But, you know, it's almost like the sort of, you know, you can't have both things. You can't have a competitive league between three or four clubs when, you know, nobody dominated for 5 years like, you know, Juve have or PSG have or you know, Man United or Arsenal did recently in the UK. In English football or Celtic or whatever, you can't have a competitive league where lots of clubs are going to exchange the title every 3 or 4 years and have one club dominant that produces lots of players who used to play with each other. Spain benefits massively from the fact that Real Madrid and Barcelona provide the sort of heartbeat of the La Croix team. So I think Peru are always going to have that sort of problem that will, I wouldn't say prevent them, but certainly make it less easy for them to sort of be competitive on the continental stage.
A nice, easy question for you then, Steve, and I'm really sorry. So how do we fix it? how do we get a more widespread different nationality success in those major continental championships?
What's needed is a South American Super League where kind of like all the Brazilian and all the Argentinian teams are bracketed together and then everyone else gets to play for the Libertadores. At the minute, you know, tongue-in-cheek, fair enough, but that's probably actually not far from the truth because it is, you know, an Argentine and Brazilian hegemony at the minute in a way that it never used to be. You know, so the last 6 or 7 years, it's just been Brazil, Argentina, and that's pretty much been it. But, you know, can I see that changing anytime soon? Not really. You know, this year's Libertadores winners will be Argentinian or Brazilian. Within that, you know, you're not going to get... It's going to be really difficult for a Peruvian side, really difficult for anyone outside of that duo, even for Uruguayan clubs. You know, it's just so difficult to bridge that gap. You know, you look at Universitario, you know, 2011, they won the under-20 Copa Libertadores, but, you know, that didn't equate to kind of like success at senior level, you know, across the coming decade. But, you know, you can still celebrate what they've done in the past. I mean, that Universitario run to the final in 72 was magnificent. You know, they went up against Alianza in the early stages of that year's competition. You know, to take out the Uruguayan giants of Nacional and Peñarol, you know, it takes some doing in 1972, and then to, you know, give Libertadores Independiente, you know, a fight in the final. You know, that's the near miss. That's the one. We can point to Sporting Cristal in 97, but, you know, I think 72 is the one for the romantics. But I just don't see them kind of like coming back to jail unless there's just like a really odd mad year, a bit like when, you know, Porto won in 2004 the Champions League, a bit like when Liverpool won it in 2005. To be fair, but I just can't see that happening because the best of Peruvian football is soon scalped. It's just massively difficult for them to be able to bridge that gap.
Oh, that's depressing medium for our Peruvian listeners. But that's okay. It's not a problem. We'll keep on and we'll still champion the cause for the sides from Peru and all the other South American nations, bar Argentina and Brazil. Next bit then, Pete, and obviously big games depend on how many, you know, sort of clubs exist in the city. So first of all, you know, the big games and, you know, what those traditional big games are in Lima, what gets the fans excited, what stops the city, you know, what people look for on the fixture calendar when it comes out, okay, what country you're in. If you're a football fan, there will be those games that you look for when the fixtures are announced. And then, obviously, guys, don't forget, there is the famous game section that I introduced for a second, which we'll also chat about.
I mean, the big game is obviously the aviation derby, you know, where people are, you know, they're kind of flying their planes. It's a real dogfight between Jorge Chavez and Juan Miguel Abusic. If we're going to do puns, I've been waiting to bring that one in. So, yeah, was that 45, 50 minutes into the episode? Yeah, I mean, the main derby,
very obviously. Very restrained. I'd have been in there within 5 minutes.
Yeah, I mean, I like to keep him waiting. Steve,
I mean, I'm just going to rewind this about 20 minutes. I thought about 10 minutes after Gary mentioned that the Napoli kit with the for Valentine's Day came on it, I thought, do you know what? I really should have asked, where do we buy those from? Is it Moonpig or is it actually from a, you know, or Clint, or is it from a sports shop?
We're going to get Andy Zaltzman is going to be loving that. I think we should send him a link, you know, as the kind of pun king, you know. So, no, I think going back, the big derby is the Universitario Alianza Lima. Even though the kind of identities that once kind of dominated, the game, they're not really there. I mean, I think I'm going to bring in my big game now, actually, because it's the most famous derby between the two of them, and it's called the Clásico de los Bastonazos. And what happened was, which kind of means the walking sticks or the walking canes, Bastonazos. So what happens is that there are various kind of tensions going on in the game. It's the 23rd of September 1928. It's one of the first derbies between the two teams, between the two teams, and It leads to five Alianza Lima players and two Universitario players being sent off. And both clubs have slightly different versions of what kicked it off. The Universitario fans will argue that there were a series of kind of ungentlemanly type behaviour and violence being produced by the Alianza players and fans. The Alianza players and fans traditionally point to, you know, elements of racism going on from the stands, but it basically leads to a pretty big fight. The reasons why it's called the derby of the walking sticks is because this is apparently what the Universitario fans were using to try and beat off the Alianza fans and players in the kind of general melee and altercation that kind of damaged the game. So that's really the kind of the origins of it all. And people still look back to that kind of founding myth of the big fight and where the kind of rivalry was really embedded. The other rivalries that exist, obviously, you do have those. The games between Sporting Cristal, Universitario, between Alianza and Sporting Cristal, between Universitario and Deportivo Municipal. That particular one, the Universitario versus Deportivo Municipal, is known as the Modern Classic, not a particularly great name. But that was actually a big game in the 1930s and 40s, when actually Deportivo Municipal were pretty much up there. You know, that's the decade when they won their four trophies. But I think you don't have that same level of, you know, huge rivalries apart from that Universitario Alianza League. That's the one that's got the most riding on it. Although the derby, whenever the other two teams are playing against Sporting Cristal, that will often tend to be, you know, one of those kind of title decider, six-pointer type games.
I love that rivalry exists. I love that it's there, and I love the tradition of rivalries. Okay, so Gary, I'm going to come to you first. Famous game?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm going to talk about a game that's not actually a club game in Lima, but it was an international game. It was back in 1964 when Peru played Argentina. I think it was in Olympics qualifier or something like that. And actually, it was a game when 300 fans died and 500 were injured after the referee disallowed a late Peruvian goal and the fans invaded the pitch. And it's not, this is nothing funny, this is a tragedy. I mean, we talk about, you know, people dying in games. You see fans invading the pitches in South America and you wonder why there's not a catastrophe. And, well, this was a catastrophe in 1965. As I say, you know, 300 fans died. And this wasn't, you know, this wasn't a World Cup final. It wasn't an Olympic final. It was a qualifying game for the 1964 Olympics. And so that was the one I was going to sort of float up just to sort of illustrate the passion for football that exists in Lima.
Right, yeah, that is incredible. And again, things that shouldn't be forgotten and probably do unite the football community no matter where you're from and where you are. Stephen, for you, big game, famous game?
Yeah, there was 1949, I go back to. And Universitario were turned over 9-1 by Alianza. One of these great games that kind of like the vanquished fans will kind of like complain bitterly that it was fixed or there were connotations behind it. And it has kind of, I don't know, it mirrors a little bit a similar result around maybe a year earlier when Real Madrid ran up a similar score against Barcelona. And it goes as a kind of like a historical stain, almost for the winners as much as it is for the losers. Because of just that ambiguity over how, you know, a result like that can come between two massively predominant football clubs. And it's just that type of result that just leaves you wanting to know more about it.
I'll give you another detail of rivalries if you want. There's the other big derby, the other famous classical. I love these classicals that get a name, you know, there's like the classical of the walking sticks. There's another one called the classical of the abandonment or the classical of shame, when apparently Alianza were winning 2-0, but then had three players sent off and were starting to struggle. So then two of their players agreed to get injured pretty much at the same time and kind of collapsed in agony and had to be carried off, in which case the game was called off. So that's the other big one. And again, a petty detail of rivalry is that the one of the kind of the barras, the kind of the organized fan groups of Alianza Lima are called Comando Sur, but they don't spell the second bit with a U because Universitario are La U, they're known as the U. So instead of it being spelled S-U-R, they spell it S-V-R, just because I don't want to have anything to do with U's at all. So this is the kind of level of pettiness that we're talking about in the fandom. So, yeah, there's another detail that explains the rivalry.
I've got to say, I love, I have a lot time for that.
Everton klaxon. That's very Everton.
That is
very much wearing blue Santa suits, blue and white Santa suits.
It's right up there.
Everton are going to change the name. To Everton to a U. It's called himself Everton because
that would be great.
Yeah. Yeah, that'll be the next step when they're moving grounds. They'll remove every letter in the word Everton that's actually written within the name of Liverpool, which will leave them with, I think, an N or something like that, will
they? And a T.
Maybe a T and N and one E. Toe. We could have to call them Toe.
For all Everton fans watching, I think we should sort of identify that with Stevie commenting on that.
Little Toe. We'll call them from now on.
Oh, brilliant. That's not where I thought that section was going. I'm not going to lie. But that's okay. Well, Stephen, you got there. Excellent marksmanship by you. So again, Pete, you know, the last sort of thing that we look at, or the last big section that we look at, and that's famous players and managers from Lima. Not necessarily that stayed there for their entire career, but more, you know, either had an influence in games there or went on to bigger and better things.
Yeah, I think, I mean, we could talk about the 70s generation as being, you know, a lot of the people that I guess the football tragics like ourselves will probably know. But I'm actually going to go further back to talk about the real two legends of the key two clubs. The first one is for Alianza Lima. He is a guy called Alejandro the Hosepipe Manguera Villanueva. He is the person at the stadium Alianza is named after. He had a tragically short life. He died from tuberculosis at 35, but he is really what kicked off Peruvian football in the style that it became known of in the 30s. And he's one of the leading figures between the great Peruvian Olympic side of 1936 in Berlin that kind of left the competition in a huff after the game against Austria was ordered to be replayed. Manguera was a pioneer. He was a master of style. He was, again, one of those players that is associated being the founder of the overhead kick. It originally was known as the snail kick when he first apparently developed it. But that's one of those, you know, urban myths or legends of football that Villanueva, his surname, I call him Manguera because the nickname. But yeah, he was rumoured to be part of, you know, the person that created that. He is part of a great Alianza Lima team that figured other people like Juan Valdivieso was a goalkeeper that apparently got bored of being goal, played up front one game and scored 7 goals. You have a guy called Lavalle who was known for dancing on the touchline and bringing a handkerchief out of his pocket to kind of celebrate and dance with to one of the polkas and that had been playing on the stands. This was the kind of the style that became emblematic of that particular Alianza team. And again, one of the great kind of pioneers of football in, you know, one of the first Peruvian great footballer is probably Alejandro Villanueva. The Universitario also have a kind of the club legend that was playing a similar kind of time in the 1930s. And his name was Teodoro Lolo Fernandez, again, known as Lolo by pretty much everyone. He played his whole career at La U. His brother played there as well. He is still, I think, the leading scorer for the club with something like 156 odd goals. You know, he scored and he was one of the Copa America back in 1939 at Peru won. He was a top scorer in that as well. You know, again, this kind of emblematic, direct, fast, powerful, you know, goal scorer whose kind of shot would break the net, you know, contrasted to Villanueva that was the skill and the flair. You know, Fernandez was the kind of the powerhouse dynamo that again led to the previous stadium of Universitario being named after him. So they're the two great footballers. They're the two real legends of club football in Lima. There are various other figures. You know, Teofilo Cubillas, we all know, is seen as being a great hero of Alianza. You know, you've got people like Sotil, again, was Alianza. Two of the reasons why the likes of Cubillas and a guy, again, called Cesar Cueto, is a very fine midfielder, a particularly well-known for Alianza, was because they came back out of retirement to play for the club after the terrible air crash, which earned them a kind of, you know, respect and law and, you know, admiration from a lot of their fans. It's probably worth mentioning Luis Escobar as well, who was, you know, that kind of Duncan Edwards figure, you know, the great hope. I think he was known as the Wild Horse, if I remember. I think he was only 18 when he died in that air crash. So he was that kind of the guy that everyone hoped that could make it, the new great star whose life was cut tragically short. I mean, there's lots of other great figures. I'll just pick out a couple. There was one who was a midfielder called Roberto Palacios, who was known as Chorri. He played for Sporting Cristal, and he had a kind of trademark goal. He was one of those kind of thunder bastard goal scorers of lore, and his goal, and they were actually named Chorri Golazos. You know, in Peru, if you score one of those kind of thunder bastards, I think they're still called a Chorri Golazo. And again, another detail of a player that is long forgotten. I mean, can anyone name the Peruvian who scored a hat-trick against England? There's a guy called Juan Seminario back in the 50s who scored a hat-trick for the Peruvian side against England. And he was kind of one of the great players of Deportivo Municipal. And again, there are various others like Roberto Tito Drago and Maximo Mosquera that were part of what was called the Black Steamroller Peruvian national team, and actually the team that played in Deportivo Cali as well. So they're the kind of the fun figures of the past that maybe we quite haven't heard of. And we could look at Farfan and, you know, some of these more recent players that start their careers at some of these clubs but then leave and maybe don't have the same connections with the club as you know, the old legends like Lolo Fernandez and like Villanueva. And so on and so forth.
Gary, you got any more players or managers to add to that impressive documentation?
Yeah, I want to look at some coaches, actually. I mean, Alianza have had some sort of famous coach. I mean, Pete mentioned Teofilo Cubias, but also Didi, who was a famous Brazilian player and managed the Peruvian national team in the 1970 World Cup. But also, there's a fascinating guy who managed to the title both clubs, both Alianza and Universidad, which is a guy called Juan Hoberg, who was actually Argentinian, and he took Alianza to the title in 1977 and 1978, and having already won the title with Universitario in 1974, but he also managed the Chilean national team in the 1970 World Cup. Very pragmatic approach, as you might almost expect from an Argentinian manager. The other guy I wanted to mention from Universitario was the first English manager to win a title in Peru, which is Jack Greenwell, who won the title with Universitario in 1939. Moving on to Sporting Cristal, probably one of the most famous Peruvian players of all time, Alberto Gallardo, who also played for Milan and Cagliari in Serie A, and they play at the Estadio Alberto Gallardo as well. And he managed the club on three different occasions. Chumpitaz, Hector Chumpitaz, Captain America, also coached the club briefly, as did Juan Carlos Oblitas, famous player from the World Cup as well. So there's been some fantastic players who have sort of managed the clubs that Pete mentioned. So, yeah, coaches there have been, you know, world-famous coaches.
Again, you know, it doesn't matter where we look and where we go. In terms of managers and coaches, there is always, or seemed to me, certainly as a layman, there certainly seems to be inspiration and innovation in terms of coaching within these countries, within these clubs, but never then make the adjustments to the big leagues or the big European leagues.
No, again, it's just, I think it just comes down to the more populist shopping centres, basically, when it comes to South American coaches and players, isn't it? You know, for Peruvians, I don't know, is it such a curse that they get overlooked? You know, it just makes the domestic game that much more interesting over there. You know, yes, we were saying earlier on that, you know, it would take a lot for them to win a Libertadores, but, you know, it doesn't diminish from just how rich and you know, varied, eclectic, you know, eccentric Peruvian football can be. You know, I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, you know, for the wider Peruvian game that, you know, the coaches don't really kind of like travel. Going back to players, though, if I could throw a player into the mix there, yeah, for me, it has to be Deportivo Municipal's excellent attacking Japanese midfielder, Masakatsu Soa. The first Japanese player ever to score in the Copa Sudamericana, who at the time was playing for a club called Colonel Bolognese, which, you know, was just, we have to find out more about this club. But he was for three separate spells at Deportivo Municipal. He's just, yeah, it's like a man with a suitcase. You know, how does this Japanese footballer become, you know, such a, you know, an integral part of Peruvian club football to such an extent that they did actually invite him to play for the national team, and he turned them down, being such a proud, you know, product of Japan. You know, as much as Peru became his second home, he still couldn't kind of like bring himself to represent a national team that wasn't, you know, his place of birth. You know, a magnificent footballer by all accounts.
He's not actually one of the first Asiatic players to have made done really well in Peruvian football. Back in the days of the great Alianza team, there was a guy called, I think it was Jorge Cuchoy, who was a second generation Chinese immigrant, and his father had been left China to work and come to Peru and worked on the guano fields and worked in kind of poor labor conditions and the kind of the bird poo boom of the kind of 1870s, 1880s. He was part of that. And Jorge Cuchoy was part of that great team with Lavalle, with Villanueva, with Valdivieso, with Lavalle, with the Rostain brothers as well. So he was part of that, you know. And again, I suppose you won't find many players of a Chinese heritage, at least, that are kind of, you know, making the name in South American football in the 1920s. So, you know, there's another.
But within that, you know, it makes, you know, South America is that bit more trailblazing than Europe ever was in that respect. You know, we can look at Sergio Etchigo being such an integral part of Brazilian football. You know, the inspiration behind, you know, Rivellino's style of play. You know, so, you know, it's that, I think it's always that aspect about South American football is that talent rises no matter where it comes from. You know, they'll find a way.
Life finds a way. I do like Jeff Goldblum in Jurassic Park, but yeah, it does find a way. Okay, guys. So as always, it's been incredibly informative and educational and very enjoyable for me, as it always is. But there comes a point now where I have to take you to that scenario of you're going to stay where you are in Lima. We're going to leave you there for arguably the rest of your life, or maybe we'll just leave you there for a season. Which or who or whom are you supporting for your time, your sojourn in Lima? I think we'll start with you, Pete, first. You've been on fire tonight. You can absolutely go for it. Not that you're not always. Please don't think that.
Just
exceptional tonight.
I desperately want to go and support Atletico Fridge. You know, I mean, the fun I think we'd have, you know, the chance. I can just imagine, you know, the joy, you know, the kind of fancy dress, you know, come as a fridge item. I mean, I don't think they still exist. I would love it if they did. I'm also desperately keen for Sport Juan Bielovucic to exist, just because I want to see how you chant that. You know, I want to see how you get a, give me a B, give me an E, give me an I. We forgot what it is. Just it put itch at the end, and that's probably it. You know, I don't think it exists. The serious answer is I think I'm going to go along to Deportivo Municipal. They feel like my kind of club, you know, not achieving a huge amount, but they're there and that matters. And I want to be there as well. And I want to say we were bloody good in the late 30s and early 40s. And that's when football really mattered. None of this money related stuff, you know, none of these other clubs in the country joining in, you know, that's where football really mattered. So, yeah, that's what I'm going to head along to Deportivo Municipal and speak of the memories of Roberto Drago and Maximo Mosquera with the lads on the terraces there. I think that's where I'm off to.
I feel like you're putting a bid to be club president with that speech. Okay, that's excellent, Gary. Whose terraces are you going to be on?
Well, I'll be massively tempted to go to the Jorge Chavez because it's an airport's named after him, so it'd be like supporting Heathrow or Gatwick. I mean, sort of, you know. Can you go and support Gatwick FC? I mean, probably not so much. But I think, you know, because it's just the way I am, I'd go to Sporting Cristal because even if the football's rubbish, you could have a beer there. So I'd go to watch the Brewers at Sporting Cristal. Because, you know, it's also the Stadio Alberto Gallardo as well. So, you know, pay homage to the great guy.
All the cigarettes and alcohol for Gary. That's what he's doing for his year in Lima. Stephen, final choice for you. Sash kits aside, where or whom are you supporting?
Well, I'm taking a wide berth of the Lima branch of the Oasis fan club.
I thought you meant.
I will go and explore the classic of yesteryear. I will need to go and watch, you know, the cricket club take on Ciclista, you know, do the ultras of the cricket club show up in pads? Do the Ciclista ultras show up on bikes. You know, it'd be great. You know, yeah, I need to know all these questions. Clearly, these things aren't going to happen, but you know, I'd like to think that they do. Until I see otherwise, then they do happen. But beyond that, having explored that, I'm with Pete at Deportivo Municipal. They are the pen pushers, according to Pete's description of them. There's none of that religious context that's going to upset, you know, many people. And you know, come on, lads, can't we all just get along? I'm not getting involved in any of that. I'm going to go to, you know, the pen pushers at Deportivo Municipal, who do reassuringly wear a kit with a sash. You know, that's the deal maker as well.
You see, perfect football environment for all of you. Although I'm not going to lie, I would love to see turn up at a football match in cricket flannels in white. I think that would just be spectacular.
It'd be like a darts match, wouldn't it? You know, they'd be like tipping up at Blackpool and everyone's dressed as kind of like, you know, crayons and all that type of stuff. But the classic of yesteryear is going to be the closest thing ever to a darting football match.
Love that. Guys, as always, it's been brilliant. It's great that we're back on the road and we're all back together again. Gary, do you want to reveal where we are, our next trip?
Well, I'll drop a teaser. We're going from the northwest to the southeast of the continent and to a country, a city that I think, if I'm right in saying, actually the capital city has more people living in that city than is the rest of the country combined.
I have no idea where we're going based on that. but I have the list. But thank you anyway. Enjoyed it, Gary?
Yeah, it's been brilliant. I mean, I don't think I've done a podcast series before where I've laughed so much. And learned so much as well. So yeah, another great episode.
This is modern learning. This is. I feel like this is how Pete should do his lectures.
This is the way to go.
It really is. Yeah, it's not serious at all. There's all kinds of punning going on when we're talking about Latin American film, I can tell you now.
Yeah, one day, Pete, I'm going to sneak into your uni, sit in one of your lectures at the back and wave and talk about Hanna-Barbera cartoons.
Oh, please, yeah. Don't disturb the guys kind of snoozing in the back row when you come in. So.
Stephen, have a good time.
Oh, joy as always. These podcasts in particular. I mean, we look at all the podcasts we do, but these are just kind of like, yeah, they've got a class of their own.
You should have a classification.
Well, I'm not saying how high that class is. Whether that's low, yeah. I am not defining exactly where, but it's in a complete class of its own.
Well, I can go with that. And Pete, as always, like I say, just brilliant. Man of the match every week. Another great performance by you.
No, well, you know, it's just a joy. It's just fun to talk about. I mean, you know, this kind of thing actually would be my dream university degree. You know, talking about the teaching side of it, I haven't yet got to kind of design my South. Well, no, I've got it designed. I've got a perfect idea of my kind of South American sport module and how to teach it and everything else. And, you know, I mean, I guess I'd put these on the listening list of stuff to kind of, you know, do when they can't be bothered to read that slightly dry and dusty, you know, 10,000 word article. So no, it's always fun. Always a pleasure. Always a good laugh to chat about it with you guys. So yeah, always good.
Do you think you'd have it as guest speakers on your program?
We get a few people to come in and talk about the 1982 Brazil team and the 1970 team, and probably find a way to try and get the Cup Winners' Cup, you know, South American significance somewhere in there. I'm sure we could find a way.
Oh, brilliant! Well,
there'd be a way.
And again, I'm going to go back to Jeff Goldblum. Life finds a way. We'll find a way, Pete. Don't worry. Guys, thank you ever so much. Gary's left you, those of you who are still listening, obviously not the Everton fans, but everyone else, as to where we're going to be next time. So, like I said, please, thank you for listening, and please join us again next time on the LOB podcast, the South American Files, the City's version, second leg. It's such a mouthful of the series, but please join us again. Thank you, and goodbye.
Many thanks for joining us today on the LOB, a These Football Times production. For more of our content, check out our award-winning print magazine featuring some of the game's foremost writers, artists, and photographers, exploring areas of the game rarely covered in high-end print. For now, we look forward to you joining us again soon.